Mount Cuba Center supports WHYY and offers special family-friendly programming on the second Saturday of every month. October 10th features hayrides through Mount Cuba Center's natural lands, with apple cider, crafts, and fall gardening tips for your own backyard. Mount Cuba Center is a botanical garden located in Hockessin, Delaware, that promotes the conservation of native plants and the habitats that sustain them. Featuring native woodlands, a colorful meadow, tranquil ponds, and historic formal gardens. More at mtcubacenter.org.
The excavator operator charged in connection to a deadly building collapse in Center City, Philadelphia in 2013 testified today during the murder trial of his former boss. I'm Brad Linder, in for Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Aaron Mozell has been covering the case. Aaron, tell us what led to this.
So this murder trial, as you said, is more than 2 years in the making. On June 5th, 2013, that was a Wednesday, a three-story freestanding wall of a building being demolished at 22nd and Market Streets collapsed onto the neighboring Salvation Army thrift store. That collapse killed six people, injured 13 others who were inside of the store at the time. Some of them were shoppers, others were employees. Two men were arrested and charged afterwards. One was Griffin Campbell. He's the general contractor for the site. The other is Sean Benscop, who was the excavator operator and who was chipping away at the building right before the wall came down. I should mention here that the building's owner, Richard Bassiano, has not been charged. Campbell and Benscop, they were each charged with third-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, and aggravated assault. In July, Benscop pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter and other charges. The murder charges were dropped as part of that deal. Campbell was offered the same deal, but he rejected it, so now he's on trial and possibly facing life in prison. Prosecutors are arguing that Campbell knew he was putting lives at risk by cutting corners during demolition, most notably that Campbell okayed the use of heavy machinery like the one that Benscop was using. Most experts have testified that this building should have been taken down by hand, top to bottom. The defense is arguing that Campbell is a scapegoat who's essentially paying for the mistakes made by people, more well-connected people above him.
So what's happened so far in this trial?
So before today, there's been a number of witnesses in the case. One of the most notable was Plato Marinakis, who was the site's architect. He said throughout, even before during the preliminary hearing, that Campbell was in charge of the site, that it was his choice to tear down the building this way. And he also said, most notably, that he had warned Campbell about the wall even the night before the collapse and said, you got to take care of that. It's too dangerous. There are people that are going to be next door. Please take care of it. Campbell told him, yeah, I'll take care of it. And as we know, he didn't. Other workers on the site have also testified, and they've sort of said that they also brought up similar concerns about the wall. There's also been some pretty painful testimony from victims of the collapse, including Maria Pleakin. She was the last person recovered from the site. If you remember, she was the woman who was trapped in the rubble for more than 12 hours, and she lost both her legs as a result.
How did people react to that testimony?
I think most people found it pretty difficult, and she did as well. She had to pause a few different times, just sort of collect herself. She was very teary-eyed, but she seemed determined to get it out.
This is the second week of the trial. What happened today specifically?
So today, John Benscop was on the stand. He was the excavator operator, as we said, and he was sort of testifying as part of his plea deal with prosecutors. As a veteran demo guy, Benscop said that he knew what he was doing was dangerous. He knew that he should have not been using this heavy machinery, specifically because the Salvation Army thrift store was occupied, and you're never supposed to be using heavy machinery when you know the building right next door has people inside. But he also said that he needed a paycheck and that he was waiting on money to come in from a previous job. And so he sort of felt like he was in a tough spot. He knew it was dangerous, but he also needed money to feed his family and pay his bills. He actually called it a no-win situation, and also said that he should have walked off the job before the collapse. And so ultimately he decided to take responsibility by pleading guilty.
So what happens next?
So next, this case is sort of winding down, I'll say. There's not that much longer. The Commonwealth is expected to wrap up sometime tomorrow, and the rest of the case could be complete, by the end of next week. And most notably, before that happens, Griffin Campbell is expected to testify in his defense.
WHYY's Aaron Mozell has been covering the building collapse trial. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has been through a rough stretch in recent years. Two justices have departed amid scandals involving political use of court staff, alleged self-dealing, and pornographic emails. But voters will choose three new justices November 3rd in an age in which national partisan groups often spend millions to win partisan control of state courts. WHYY's Dave Davies has this look at the strange shape of this judicial Donnybrook.
It's probably one of the most consequential and so far least noticed races in Pennsylvania history. This week, with the election less than a month away, TV ads for three candidates are finally appearing.
David Wecht is the only candidate with a plan to reform our courts. He's kept criminals off our streets and helped families in crisis.
When Pennsylvania's Supreme Court needed a new leader to oversee our state's largest court system, they turned to Judge Kevin Dougherty.
Those are ads for David Wecht of Allegheny County and Philadelphia's Kevin Dougherty, brother of the city's most prominent labor leader, John Dougherty. Those two Democrats, along with Christine Donahue, who has ads in Pittsburgh, will take on Republicans Michael George, Ann Covey, and Judith Olson, along with an independent, Paul Panapinto. Lynn Marks, director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, says there are only seven seats on the court, and three are up for grabs.
And that's more than ever before. Another thing is that Pennsylvania is the only state that is electing Supreme Court justices this year. So there's also national attention.
Indeed, it's the role of national organizations that have changed state Supreme Court elections across the country. State justices rule on matters of critical interest to political parties, such as voter access and legislative redistricting. The U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling and other court decisions have increased the flow of money into politics everywhere. Laurie Kenny is with the nonprofit Justice at Stake, which tracks spending in judicial elections.
Over the last decade and a half, state Supreme Court elections have become increasingly attractive to partisan actors, and this is the new normal. This is what we're living with in the current political climate.
Unions and trial lawyers have traditionally supported Democratic judicial candidates. But in recent years, national conservative groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Americans for Prosperity, associated with the Koch brothers, have spent big in state court races. Some analysts are puzzled that, so far, they've stayed out of the Pennsylvania contest, where partisan control of a populous state's court hangs in the balance. Democratic strategist Dan McElhattan Jr. offers an explanation. He says off-year low-turnout elections in Pennsylvania favor Republicans, so they don't want to advertise and wake up sleeping Democrats.
There would not be a reason for a Republican tactician to alert folks in southeastern Pennsylvania that an election is happening. And they think that they can win this election simply by running out the clock.
State Republican Party Chairman Robert Gleason agrees the passive voter turnout pattern in this kind of election does favor GOP candidates.
Well, it does. There's no question about that. There will be a very low turnout. So this election, like many in Pennsylvania, is a turnout election. And it's not even necessarily about spending millions of dollars on television. It's about having an effective turnout program, and that doesn't take millions of dollars.
So far, the three Democratic candidates have raised more than three times the cash the Republicans have. Gleason says he thinks the door is still open to spending from outside conservative groups. Matthew Menendez, an attorney for the Brennan Center for Justice, agrees.
Very often these groups will come in and spend at the very last minute, and so the fact that they aren't spending yet should not be read as an indication that they won't.
None of three national conservative groups contacted would discuss their plans. Meanwhile, a Pennsylvania committee funded by unions and attorneys has raised $360,000 and is expected to support the Democratic candidates. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
In today's headlines, more than 100 Philadelphia school district students cut class this morning to protest the lack of resources they see in schools. Science Leadership Academy junior Ariana Haven took the district to task for outsourcing substitute teaching services, a move that's been a major disappointment so far.
We have classes without our teachers because they're absent, and so other teachers lose their prep periods because they have to cover our classes, which is not fair to the teachers and not fair to the students because then our teachers aren't prepared, as prepared as they should be.
Source for Teachers, the private sub provider, promised a 90% fill rate for absent teachers. In the first week of school, the rate sat at 11%. Now it's ticked up to 22%. New Jersey went to court today to seize 87 publicly owned beach parcels in Margate through eminent domain. The state plans to use them for a protective dune system, despite bitter opposition from the town and its residents. The town just south of Atlantic City says its wooden bulkheads are sufficient to protect against ocean flooding, and that most of the damage from Superstorm Sandy in 2012 came from the bay on the other side of town. 10 private lots in Margate also need to be acquired. They're not part of today's court action. Checking the WHYY forecast, partly cloudy with a low around 58 degrees tonight. Tomorrow, cloudy with a high around 80. Tomorrow night, thunderstorms likely with a low near 53 degrees. Saturday, partly sunny and cooler with a high around 65. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 69. And Monday, more sunshine with a high around 75 degrees. It's 74 degrees at 6:16. Still ahead, a new play casts an iconic novel, J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, as the inspiration for assassins.
It's sort of imbued with a sense of a survived trauma.
That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
You take out a loan, you run into some trouble, you can't make your payments. Whether you get sued for defaulting on that loan or not might well depend on the color of your skin.
But there has to be something about the situation that faces black borrowers that makes them more vulnerable.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Race and Debt, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Virtua proudly supports WHYY. This is the time of year to sign up for health insurance. When choosing a health insurance plan, it's important to know whether your doctor or hospital is included. If you want to use a Virtua physician, hospital, or outpatient service, you can find out if Virtua is in the plan you're considering by calling 888-VIRTUA-3. That's 888-VIRTUA-3. Virtua proudly supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder, in for Dave Heller. About one in three women in the United States gives birth by cesarean section, according to a national report from the Leapfrog Group. But according to the World Health Organization, only about 10 to 15% of C-sections are medically necessary. Some doctors and patients like to schedule C-sections because they're convenient, but there are risks associated. Andrew Kitchman wrote about the Leapfrog Report for NJSpotlight.com and joins us on Newsworks Tonight. Andrew, what does the report tell us about C-sections in New Jersey?
Well, first and foremost, that there's a really wide variation between different hospitals. They range from about 11% up to about 43%. And that tells you that there's a lot of optional C-sections that are going on and that there's a lot of room for hospitals to improve their rates.
And what accounts for such a wide difference, 11 at some and 40 at others?
Well, some of it's cultural. That doctors get used to it over the course of decades of practicing in a certain way, and the hospitals may or may not take any steps to either encourage or discourage that. There's differences in the patient populations in different areas, and different hospitals sort of specialize in more difficult deliveries, and that may also drive up some hospitals' rate.
So who's this Leapfrog group that performed the study?
Yeah, it's a nonprofit that's based in Washington, and it's basically funded by employers, and employers are very interested in these issues because they want to get the best quality health care. Since they're frequently paying for their employees' health care, they want to get the best quality health care at the best price.
3 in 10 seems like a large number. It can be as high as 4 in 10. But in New Jersey, the rate's actually lower than it used to be, according to this report, right?
Yeah, it's gone down slightly. Now, this is the first time the Leapfrog Group did this report. But there are statewide statistics that are available for previous years. And it peaked in 2009. It's gone down very slightly since then.
And is the data that's contained in this report, is this complete, or did only a certain number of hospitals report their numbers in the first place?
Yeah, with the LeapFrog group, this was the first time they did it. In New Jersey, they had a pretty good compliance, but there were hospitals that did not respond. And that's not great. Part of their goal in gathering the information is to encourage hospitals to put that information out there. And they anticipate over time that more hospitals will report this data.
And why does this matter at all?
Well, basically because non-cesarean section or vaginal delivery births are healthier for both the moms and the babies. It lowers the risk of infections and all the various complications that can result from any surgery of the abdomen. And there's also some evidence that the kind of hormones that moms have during vaginal birth benefit the babies as well.
And are there costs associated with the different types of surgery too?
Yeah, C-sections are actually more expensive. And they grew really rapidly from about 1970 to the late 2000s nationally. The rate was once about 5%.
What led to the change? What led to the more of these optional ones? Do we know that?
Yeah, to some extent, it was really driven by convenience, often for the doctors who were comfortable doing it this way. Also, like induced deliveries or early elective deliveries, you can schedule them.
And so what can mothers-to-be or women who are thinking about having children, what can they do with this kind of information, knowing that there's a huge discrepancy between some hospitals and others in terms of the rates of C-section deliveries?
A couple things. One is they can look at the LeapFrog group report and see the variations. And if they're looking at different hospitals, they may want to prioritize hospitals that have a lower rate. Probably most importantly, they can have a conversation with their doctor and ask them about the pros and cons of both.
Andrew Kitchenman is healthcare reporter for NJSpotlight.com. Andrew, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Brad.
In Pennsylvania, there are also big discrepancies in other aspects of women's health care. In this case, they center around costs. The price of a mammogram in Philadelphia's metro region can be anywhere from $100 to $700. That's according to a new analysis from the private company Castlight Health. WHYY's Alana Gordon has more.
Healthcare prices can be really hard to get, but Castlight has access to a lot of information through working with businesses and analyzing what they and their employees actually pay for that care. Their survey of employer claims information from this past year found that in Philadelphia, prices for various women's health services can vary a lot depending on where a person goes for care. Eric Mann with Castlight says an HPV test can cost anywhere from $30 to $300, a mammogram anywhere from $100 to $700, and a preventive visit anywhere from $80 to $400.
So that's a huge difference, and that has, you know, very real implications.
There's a lot of theories on why such variation exists, but Mann says the point is that it can impact employers and employees in terms of costs.
A significant portion of women delay care because they don't think that they can afford it. A significant number of women don't get potentially life-saving things like mammograms because they can't afford it or don't believe they can afford it.
The study only highlights aggregate information, so it doesn't give doctor-specific details. But Mann says knowing that such variation is out there means it may pay to shop around and ask a doctor what the expected cost will be beforehand. I'm Alana Gordon, WHYY News.
A play opens this weekend in Philadelphia that gathers the celebrated author of The Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger, with assassins who were inspired to kill after reading the novel. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the play imagines Salinger in a room with Mark David Chapman and John Hinckley Jr.
The room is a bunker J.D. Salinger had built on his property in New Hampshire where he would sequester himself to write. That part is true. What's also true is that after killing John Lennon, Mark David Chapman sat down on the sidewalk to read his copy of Catcher in the Rye. What is not true is that Chapman and David Hinckley, another fan of the novel who attempted to assassinate President Ronald Reagan, ever met Salinger in person. The play also imagines a fourth person, a fictitious young man, who appears to be plotting a mass shooting. Salinger's three visitors are reviewing an unpublished manuscript.
Hey, new guy. How true is this statement for you? In his mind, fulfillment meant loving a good woman and killing a bad man.
Salinger never actually wrote that. That was by science fiction writer Robert Heinlein.
Look, just give me like the number, 1 through 10. 10's 100% true.
The play, called Holden, takes lots of poetic liberties to get inside the heads of men who kill. Playwright Anissa George points out that parts of Catcher in the Rye were written while Salinger was serving in World War II.
It's sort of imbued with a sense of a survived trauma, and we were interested in how those traumatic experiences could have been sublimated and reemerge in the cracked minds of these assassins of the 1980s.
Despite the title, the character Holden does not appear in this play. George says teenage anxiety and dissociation of that protagonist from Catcher in the Rye gives insight to mass shootings in America.
We started working on it really intensely in June, and then there was Charleston, and then there was Chattanooga, and there was Lafayette, and now Oregon, and it just feels surreal. You know, it feels absurd and surreal how often this goes on.
Holden plays at Fringe Arts this weekend and next. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, this fall was supposed to be the return of Delaware's Pumpkin Chunking Contest, but it'll have to wait another year. Contestants use catapults, air cannons, and other contraptions to hurl the gourds. The organizers say even though they had planned to move the event to Dover International Speedway to avoid legal and insurance concerns, they ran out of time. Speedway spokesperson Gary Camp says it happened quickly.
I think just as of yesterday morning, they realized that their event wouldn't be insured.
Camp says the Speedway is willing and able to host the contest in 2016, and those who already bought tickets for this year will get a full refund. It was canceled last year after the farm that had hosted Pumpkin Chunkin' for decades said it couldn't do so anymore for fear of lawsuits. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Dave Heller returns tomorrow. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. After 3 decades, one of Philadelphia's largest and most storied chunks of vacant land is now slated for redevelopment. On tomorrow's show, we'll hear the plans for the site of the sinking homes of Logan. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for Newsworks Tonight.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
Morris Arboretum in Chestnut Hill supports WHYY and celebrates fall with its annual Scarecrow Walk from October 6th through October 25th. 35 designer scarecrows on display along Morris Arboretum's Oak Alley. Visitors can stroll the 92-acre garden where autumn is in its glory, and there are more than 50 fall classes for adults and children to meet every interest. Details at morrisarboretum.org.